closed the file and looked at the faded black-and-white framed photograph on the wall of his office. The men wore World War II-era duck hunter patterned camouflage uniforms and carried an assortment of small arms, including a Johnson M1941 held by Vic's father. Never again, Vic thought. On the front cover of the file, he signed his name over his director's signature block and checked a box marked Approved. Chapter 2. Angola, Africa. Angola had not been particularly good to Ismael Tehrani. He was getting impatient. It had been 6 years since he had left Lebanon to become one of the 8 million diaspora, Lebanese citizens living beyond the borders. Unique to this group was that they vastly outnumbered their countrymen who stayed behind and continued to endure the chaos the past 40 years had brought to the small republic on the Mediterranean Sea. He missed his native country, but he was on a mission. He had been personally recruited by Al-Sayed Hassan. Well, not directly, but an order from an emissary of the Secretary General of Hezbollah was as good as an edict from God. It was said that Hassan Nasrallah was a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. Who was Ismael Tehrani to turn down an opportunity to serve Allah at the bidding of the man who had pushed the Israeli dogs from southern Lebanon? Ismael was only a child when the Israeli rockets and artillery had rained down on the Shiite slums of South Beirut. Hunkered in a corner of their one-room apartment with his mother and cousins, they'd lost electricity almost immediately, yet did not risk lighting a candle. His mother had covered him with a thick blanket. The sound of the incoming bombardment and subsequent explosions were endured in darkness. The devastation he witnessed the following morning when he ventured outside cemented his resolve. He would defend his homeland from the invaders. The war that saw more than 4,000 Katyusha rockets fired into Israel and the destruction of critical infrastructure in Lebanon from Israeli warplanes did more than polarize the Arab world. It provided Hezbollah's Jihad Council with an army of young recruits willing to die for the cause. When his father returned from working in Africa to protect his family at the onset of the July War, Ismael remembered him saying that the President of the United States called the Israeli actions part of his war on terror, and that his Congress even voted in support of the Israeli onslaught. To Ismael and his family, it was nothing more than American-funded genocide. Ismael's first taste of combat would surprisingly not be against the Israelis, as he so hoped, but instead against fellow Muslims in Syria, albeit Takfiris. His brigade commander had explained that Hezbollah could not allow Syria to collapse and come under the control of the United States and Israel. Allah needed his warriors to be strong. Syria could not fall, especially in a Zionist plot to overthrow Bashar al-Assad. Most of Hezbollah's weapons passed through Syria from Iran, and that conduit needed to remain open. It was their lifeblood. He'd heard whisperings that Nasrallah wanted to take territory and open another front against Israel in the Golan Heights. Ismael was in full support, parroting the slogans beaten into them by their instructors as they marched during indoctrination, and then in their more formal training in the West Bekaa Valley. Death to Israel, death to America, eradicate the Jews. Fighting in the Syrian town of Al-Qusair, Ismael found combat a confusing mix of screaming, shooting, and mayhem. He generally pointed his weapon in the same direction as those in his brigade. He shot when they shot and ran when they ran. A friend he'd known since birth stepped on a landmine. They had not even stopped to pick up the pieces. Another warrior of God had taken a bullet to the face in mid-sentence as he stood to order his militia forward, leaving Ismael covered in chunks of bone and brain. Ismael had fought. He had not faltered. He drew strength from the passage written above their yellow and green flag, depicting a fist clenching a rifle, similar to the one in Ismail's hands. Fa'inna hizbullahum alaybun. Then surely the party of God are they that shall be triumphant. Hezbollah won the day. Ismail had heard whispers of Unit 910, Hezbollah's external security apparatus responsible for targeting Israeli assets abroad, but had never dared ask about or even speak of them. It was rumored they were also responsible for the assassination of the Lebanese prime minister, though Hezbollah denied the allegation and shifted blame to Israel. When they pulled him from his unit, it was not so much an ask as it was an order. Ismail had been given a task, one that required him to receive additional training by the IRGC Quds Force in Iran. The Quds Force is an elite paramilitary unit responsible for external operations, specializing in the use of proxy forces unattributable to Iran. The West would brand them terrorists regardless of their targets. Born of the 1979 Iranian Revolution, they were accountable only to the Ayatollah himself. Their intelligence apparatus taught Ismail how to assess and recruit assets, identify facilitators, set up safe houses, conduct reconnaissance and surveillance, and transfer information via a clandestine communications network back to Hezbollah. And they taught him to build truck bombs. The Party of God wanted Ismail in Angola. Though Hezbollah had worldwide reach through its network of diaspora, they were underrepresented in this southwestern African country where the corrupt government had outlawed Islam, no doubt at the behest of the Jews. Mosques had been burned and Muslims persecuted. Hezbollah needed a trusted agent in the area to gather information for the Jihad Council. Israel's embassy in the capital city of Luanda was a target, and Nasrallah wanted to know just how soft an objective it was. Finally, Ismail Tehrani would strike a blow against the Zionist aggressors. Though a step up from the horrors of Al-Qusayr, Angola was a country in transition. After a decade and a half of struggle in a war of liberation against the Portuguese colonists and a follow-on quarter century of civil war, the nation and its people were no strangers to conflict. Those years of strife had conditioned the new ruling class to exercise extreme measures to keep the populace in check. Disappearances of those critical of the Angolan government were commonplace. Torture, gang rape, and public executions were utilized as a means of controlling the populace. This was Africa. Ismail was in the capital when, after 38 years in power, President José Eduardo dos Santos finally stepped down. He had amassed a multi-billion-dollar fortune in a country where the average person lives on $2 a day. For the quasi-dictator of one of the most corrupt regimes in all of Africa, the ability to make $32 billion in oil revenue disappear through a worldwide money laundering network had been a highly profitable skill. His King's College-educated daughter had risen to prominence and become Africa's first female billionaire as head of the nationalized Angolan State Oil Company. It certainly paid to take stakes in companies exploiting the Angolan people and their natural resources. Ismail had read of similar actions by the family of an American vice president. Corruption and greed were not ailments relegated solely to the jungles of the developing world. The northern Angolan province of Cabinda is separated from the rest of the country by a 60-kilometer strip where the Democratic Republic of the Congo intrudes into what is de jure, though disputed, Angolan territory. The lumber, cocoa, coffee, and rubber plantations occupy much of the lush landscape. Angola's most lucrative export is oil. It was into the Kuwait of Africa that Ismail followed in his father's footsteps. The mass exodus caused by more than half a century of war had created a labor vacuum. At the direction of Unit 910, Ismail applied for and was hired by an asset of the diaspora, working at Petróleo Brasileiro S.A. Petrobras, the Brazilian Petroleum Corporation, a company with major stakes in Angolan oil and natural gas production. His job was to escort labor from Luanda in the south to Cabinda in the north, a position that allowed him ample opportunity to surveil the Israeli embassy. Ismail was discouraged when his intelligence reports did not lead to immediate kinetic action. When in Luanda, he prayed to Allah, not in a mosque, but in a cramped apartment that smelled of sewage. He passed his information through the imam, who reported back to the council. He dreamed that one day the jihad assembly would order him to carry out an attack on the Jews, just as his brothers had hit their embassies in Buenos Aires and London before Ismail was even born. Ismail had taken note when his fellow warriors martyred themselves in Bulgaria, though he intended on killing more than six Israeli tourists. He wanted to drive a truck bomb right into the lobby of the Israeli embassy. His death would one day be honored on a monument, like the one his trainers had shown him in Behesht-e-Zahra Cemetery in Tehran. That attack had meant something. Less than a year after the 1983 Beirut bombings, the infidels had retreated from Lebanon. The martyrs had struck a blow for Allah and sent the Americans scurrying home. With each passing year, Ismail's hope of a glorious attack on the Jews in Angola dwindled. His recruitment by Unit 910 had been a great honor, but at times he felt abandoned in the squalid African subcontinent. Once again, the little boy covered with a blanket. When the assignment came to Ismail, it was not the one he expected. It did not entail acquiring the components to build a truck bomb for a spectacular attack for which he had been trained. It was a rather straightforward task. But one did not question orders from a descendant of the Prophet. One evening after prayers, the imam had given Ismail a package and verbally passed along his orders. Ismail was told the virus would only infect the Jews. Even so, there was a special pill for him to swallow that would ensure his safety. On his next trip north, he was to spray what looked like an asthma inhaler randomly in the marketplace of a local village. Hezbollah had information that the Israelis were secretly at work converting diamond mine workers to Judaism, all the while using the gems to fund their campaign of worldwide domination. Ismail expected nothing less of the Jews. 3 days later, he was en route to Cabinda with a new group of workers in one of the planes that Petrobras used to transport people to and from Luanda. The following afternoon, he visited a marketplace just east of the city, a market that supplied workers for the Jews. He purchased a bracelet from a woman selling jewelry off a blanket of purple and orange, and ate a meal of chikwanga and katatos from a vendor. He'd grown quite fond of the fried caterpillar dish, its spicy mixture of insects, onions, peppers, and tomatoes reminded him of the prawns from the coast of Lebanon. Ismail depressed the asthma inhaler as he moved through the crowded bazaar at 10 different places, just as he'd been instructed. Though he trusted his imam and the Hezbollah secretary general, he still took the special immunity pill, no sense in taking chances. He wanted to be sure he was healthy enough to destroy the Israeli embassy when the time was right. Within 36 hours, the local clinic in Cabinda began to admit patients exhibiting flu-like vomiting, hemorrhaging in the eyes, and bloody noses very similar to the hemorrhagic outbreaks that had occurred in the Democratic Republic of Congo, just to the east in 2014 and 2016. The same clinic had experience with a rare episode in 2005 that killed 39 children in a northern Angolan village. The next day, dozens of infected villagers began flooding the clinic, prompting a notification to the World Health Organization. Having experience in this part of the world where hemorrhagic outbreaks were not out of the ordinary, this one was quickly contained. The doctors and nurses in Equatorial Africa were well-versed in hemorrhagic virus protocols. Personal protective equipment was mandated. Bleach was used to disinfect all surfaces and equipment, and blood samples were sent to the Pasteur Institute in Dakar, Senegal, for further study. Though the index case was never identified, the data indicated that this was a small contained outbreak in a crowded, hot market, probably originating with the meat handlers. It was catalogued as yet another in a long string of mysterious hemorrhagic viruses that plagued the Dark Continent. Bodies of the dead were collected and burned in a mass crematorium, as was standard practice to destroy a fast-moving infection like Ebola. If there was a positive attribute of hemorrhagic viruses, it was that they burned themselves out quickly, often killing the host agent before they could spread the infection via blood or saliva. Thankfully, there had never been a recorded case of hemorrhagic virus spreading via respiratory pathways like the flu or a common cold. The following day, Ismail returned to the capital, depressing his inhaler in the departure area of Cuatro de Febrero International Airport, as per his instructions, before returning to his small apartment in time for evening prayers. Less than 24 hours after the release, he took a taxi to Multiperfil Hospital, thinking he had food poisoning, maybe from his meal in Cabinda. Ismail was dead the next day. 3 weeks later, his name would be listed among 457 others in a World Health Organization report that was then forwarded to the Centers for Disease Control, or CDC. The report indicated the WHO had successfully contained another Ebola outbreak in Angola. Data like that was important to the continued financial support from the United States. The name Ismail Terrani would not spike on any intelligence agency radars, even if someone had run it through a national intelligence database in Israel or the United States. His body was thrown in a pit, doused with gasoline, and set aflame. Just another casualty of hemorrhagic fever, an infectious disease not uncommon in Equatorial Africa. Chapter 3. National Biodefense Analysis and Countermeasures Center, Fort Detrick, Maryland. Colonel Tom Garrett stuck his head through the office door and nodded to Major Courtney Burke, who was on the phone with her husband. She held up a finger and mouthed, 1 minute.
Yep, I'll be home in about 4 hours. Need me to pick up dinner? Chinese? Sounds great. Love you too.
And how is everything on the home front? Garrett asked his colleague.
All is well. Peter is selling homes and juggling the kids, and I'm about to enter a place that doesn't officially exist, she said, pushing back her chair and logging out of her computer. How is Haley?
She's still saving the world at the CDC.
Does it ever strike you as odd that you are here weaponizing viruses that could destroy the world while she is working on immunizations and antidotes for those same viruses?
Every day.
Why don't you go first today? I'll finish this up, she said, pointing to some papers on her desk. Meet you there in a minute.
Colonel Garrett reached the end of the hallway, slid his ID card through a reader and punched in a 4-digit code. The door was marked Biocontainment Level 4. Only 7 facilities in the United States were approved for Bio-Level 4 contagious disease study, and the National Biodefense Analysis and Countermeasures Center in Fort Detrick, Maryland, was one of them. Created in the wake of the 2001 anthrax attacks, its official charter was to perform research on pathogens for which no vaccine or treatment exists in order to better understand the threat of bioterrorism. Unofficially, they had another mission. Unlike popular Hollywood movies, television shows, and novels, one did not first enter into biocontainment level 1, then 2, then 3, and then finally 4. That looked good on camera to up the suspense as an actor steadily worked his or her way toward the deadly viruses within. In reality, the very few doctors cleared to work with the lethal pathogens bypassed levels 1, 2, and 3. Their TSSCI clearances had an additional designation, a SAP, or Special Access Program, allowing them access to the inner sanctum of U.S. contagious disease research. Fewer still had access to another room, one that only a select number of specialists and officials knew existed. That additional room was where the colonel was going today. He looked up at a camera above the door. Before a security guard at a remote location unlocked the door, he verified the code and card and visually compared the colonel's face to his official photo on file as the facial recognition software confirmed he had approved access. Garrett entered what looked like a small locker room in any gym in America. The only difference was that instead of smelling like body odor, Old Spice, and sweaty socks, this one smelled like bleach. He maneuvered around a short steel bench and swung open the door to one of the lockers that lined the wall. He removed his clothes and hung them neatly in the locker, which sealed and locked when he closed it. He then moved to the next door. It had felt odd going through the process the first time, knowing that he was being watched on video and that every move he made was being recorded. Now, after 15 years, it was just another day at the office. Standing naked in front of the next entry point, he heard the familiar whoosh of the airlock as the door opened. He stepped into a room of stainless steel. He felt and heard the door seal behind him. Moving to the center of the room, he raised his arms. Similar to a car wash, warm, soapy liquid rained from the ceiling and walls, coating his exposed body. He closed his eyes and focused his mind on what the next 2 hours had in store. The soapy spray shifted to distilled water before the blowers came on to dry him. Putting on UV goggles, he nodded to let the controller know he was ready. An unknown finger touched a button, bathing the room in UV light that would not damage skin but would kill any foreign contaminants. The entire process took only 3 minutes. It wasn't as important on the way in as it was on the way out. The exit process would take 3 times as long to ensure the death that lived behind the walls did not see the light of day. The UV light shut off and Garrett heard the airlocks open to allow him access to the next room. He went through the process the same way a normal person would make their coffee each morning with no variation. However, with coffee, if you forgot the cream or ran out of sweetener, you wouldn't release a contagion upon an unsuspecting public, killing untold millions of your fellow countrymen. Still naked and monitored on video, he entered the small room and removed a disposable bunny suit from a stainless steel hook. He stepped into it and glanced at the incineration drawer where he would deposit it on the way out. He put a hairnet on his head before taking the rubber bioprotective suit from another hook and sealing himself inside. Lastly, he attached the helmet and tethered himself to a power and air cord that would keep him alive beyond the next set of doors. Looking up at the camera, he gave a thumbs up. He again felt the airlock engage as the next set of doors opened into an anteroom, where he reattached his tether to ensure the suit was powered and air was flowing. The doors closed behind him, leaving him sealed in a room designed to prevent any contaminants from escaping. He picked up a metal clipboard and Fisher space pen to go over the day's test while he waited for Major Burke to pass through the sterilization process and join him. There were no separate considerations given to male and female medical professionals working with infectious diseases. Perhaps the military was more progressive than it was given credit for. One door away was biocontainment level 4. The world's deadliest pathogens were mere feet away behind a brightly labeled set of airlocked stainless steel doors. Colonel Garrett knew he was still on video and was acutely aware that everything in front of him beyond the doors was also recorded for security reasons and for purposes both procedural and historical. in biocontainment level 4, the most lethal diseases known to man were studied and tested as scientists created antibodies that might one day save the human race. That was not where he was going today. Colonel Garrett and Major Burke had another mission. The door behind him opened, and Garrett watched as his partner connected her tether to power and air. Ensuring she was good to go, she flashed a thumbs up at the camera, and the doors sealed shut behind her. The two soldiers moved to a wall to their left, a wall that looked just like the others in the facility. Only this one had two alphanumeric keypads attached on opposite sides. The colonel moved to the one on the left. They were far enough away from each other so that one person could not possibly reach both at the same time. He looked at Courtney, and they both entered 7-digit access codes. If they did not both enter their codes within 10 seconds of one another, the doors would automatically lock down until credentials could be re-verified. Then supervisors up the chain of command, both military and civilian, would be required to reapprove access. A green light blinked, and the doctors looked into a small keyhole camera that they knew was using a laser to biometrically scan their faces. Only after they were approved by the system did a remote security guard grant them access. The wall parted, and they walked into a world fewer than 100 people in all of government knew existed, re-tethering to their life support system as the heavy steel doors shut behind them. While level 4 biocontainment was filled with fancy electron microscopes and had ample space for multiple scientists, this room was surprisingly small. Colonel Garrett hadn't met a doctor yet who didn't feel claustrophobic during their first experience. It wasn't necessarily the confined space or the oppressive feel of the rubber suit. Rather, it was knowing what secrets the room concealed. Only two such facilities had been constructed, and the United States government disavowed any knowledge of their existence. President Nixon had signed the Biological Weapons Convention in 1972. It went into effect on March 26, 1975, and outlawed the development, stockpiling, retention, and production of biological agents and toxins for hostile purposes, making what took place in Maryland a violation of international law. Technically speaking, the two doctors were about to commit a war crime. Instead of stainless steel tables and file cabinets or expensive microscopes and computers, this room resembled a spacious closet. Unlike biocontainment level 4, no video or audio recording devices documented the sensitive research and development that took place in this highly restricted section of the facility. The room was designed to withstand a magnitude 9 earthquake and remain intact if hit with the equivalent of 10 tons of TNT. It was equipped with a triple power backup system in case of a power outage, one of them coming from a separate section of the power grid built to withstand an electromagnetic pulse from the sun or a nuclear device. If all three failed, or if the 6-foot-thick walls were breached from the outside, it was designed to self-incinerate, killing everyone and, more important, every thing inside. The cabinets and freezer were constructed of vinyl and plastic composites, which made them more conducive to burning and melting in the 3,000-degree heat if that emergency mechanism were triggered. Its official designation, for those select few read into the program, was the Dark Room. Unofficially, by those who ventured inside, it was called the Bat Cave. Not after the Caped Crusader of comic book lore, but for the caves of Zaire, where the dreaded Ebola virus had spawned in the spore of bat guano. Behind the doors of the Bat Cave were where the contagious diseases of biocontainment level 4 were weaponized for offensive warfare. How could so much death fit inside such a small room? He even with all the security protocols set up to restrict access and knowledge of its true purpose, there was another way inside. The pedigreed baboon had started life at the Southwest National Primate Research Center in San Antonio, Texas, before being transported to his current home in Maryland. More specifically, a custom-breed Papio Anubis Papio Hamadryas, he belonged to a colony established in 1972 for this precise purpose. The colony had been genetically bred for medical research and was ideally suited for bioweapons sensitivity testing. The center's selective breeding and environmental manipulations resulted in the animals having a genetic structure similar to that of humans. The baboon had been sedated in a separate yet attached animal research facility. It was now entombed behind a thick plexiglass barrier. Using the robotic arm, Colonel Garrett opened the freezer and removed a small vial. With practiced efficiency, he extracted a sample and injected it into the test subject while Major Burke took notes. Their research involved infecting a series of animals with a new monoclonal cocktail as part of a dose-exposure curve experiment. The biomedical researchers were in search of sub-lethal viral doses of a biological agent that put the United States government in violation of international law. Today's experiment confirmed that the dose was lethal. After it was done, an automated tray removed the primate from view and sealed him inside what was essentially a crematorium. When the doors eventually opened again, not even ashes would remain. The tray was then sprayed down with a solution of chemicals before being dried with a blower and exposed to 15 minutes of intense UV light. It was as if the primate had never existed. Their work complete, the two doctors then prepared to exit the classified structure. They would pass through the four airlocks, remove their rubber bioprotective suits, incinerate their bunny suits, then receive the naked spray down and UV light treatment before their lockers would be opened and they could put their clothes back on. Once again, under audio and video surveillance, they would reemerge to join the land of the living, both making it home in time for dinner with their families, leaving the secrets of the Batcave safely behind. Chapter 4. The White House, Washington, D.C. President Alec Christensen stood behind his desk in the Oval Office, looking down on the Rose Garden through windows of ballistic glass that framed one of the most recognizable rooms in the world. He was flanked by the national flag to his left and the flag of the President of the United States to his right. He ran his left thumb across a ring that hung on a chain, hidden beneath his button-down Oxford dress shirt. It was the ring he had never been able to slide onto Jen's finger. It reminded him of death and kept him focused on his mission. It had been almost a year since his election night victory when state after state came in for the popular war hero during a time of economic and racial tension that threatened to rip the country apart. The talking heads and pollsters had been ecstatic as their projections came to fruition, especially after the brutal beating they had taken years earlier when they'd confidently projected at 100% the odds of victory for the Democratic ticket over someone they dismissed as a reality TV star with no chance of becoming president. They'd lost a substantial amount of credibility that night and were hoping to gain some of that trust back by making the right calls this time around. By all indications, the new president had shown no overt interest in politics until he recovered from the wounds he sustained in Afghanistan. To the media establishment and a populace looking for a bright light on the political scene, he was a savior. He came from money, went to all the right schools, and had focused his efforts on a small Silicon Valley startup a few years before 9/11. In campaign speeches, he didn't lead with the story that had catapulted him into the public consciousness, as he didn't want to be seen as taking advantage of Jen's memory. But then, he didn't need to. The media did that job for him. His fiancée killed on 9/11, the future president running into the burning building in an attempt to save her. The smoke inhalation being carried out unconscious by a firefighter. A firefighter who then rushed back into the North Tower only to be buried in the rubble. The young entrepreneur working in the debris for days alongside firefighters, police officers, first responders, and citizen volunteers, until collapsing from exhaustion. A journalist captured a photograph of him that would become emblematic of America's response to the attacks, covered in the gray dust of the day, not wandering in a daze as were so many others, but sleeves rolled up, crowbar in hand, eyes fiercely set, prying a slab of concrete in the desperate search for survivors, in a desperate search for Jen. When the New York Times identified him as the son of a prominent Manhattan financier and reported that his fiancée was missing in the rubble, they ran it with the headline, "The Spirit of New York." He applied to Army Officer Candidate School from his hospital bed a week later. What followed was basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia, then Rangers School, and then his first assignment with the storied 10th Mountain Division at Fort Drum, New York, before deploying to Afghanistan. After 13 months of sustained combat in a valley that would see some of the toughest battles of the War on Terror, he'd been wounded by an IED in an ambush while on a mounted patrol to a nearby village. He'd pulled himself from his burning Humvee, the screams of his dying turret gunner muffled by a ringing in his ears, a ringing that remained an ever-present eulogy to those who never made it home. He was halfway to cover when he realized he was dragging the lifeless torso of his driver, whose body from the waist down was still strapped in the vehicle. First Lieutenant Christensen had taken a 7.62x39mm round to his left hand as he made it to a rock by the side of what passed for a dirt road. Instead of rendering aid to his wounds, he called in artillery from their forward operating base and coordinated CASEVAC for the wounded. He ignored his own injuries and led a flanking element to counter the insurgents raining death down from elevated positions, the same positions he knew were probably used to attack and subsequently defeat the British and Soviets before him. Alec had returned home and written a best-selling book. His narrative did not chronicle his experience in Afghanistan, as would be expected. Instead, he profiled six families, juxtaposing fathers and sons, the fathers having volunteered for Vietnam and the sons having volunteered after 9/11. The only mention of his own service came from the preface, where he framed the stories to come. Titled, "You'll Be a Man, My Son," from the famous Kipling poem, If. Many hailed it as worthy of the Pulitzer Prize until he threw his hat in the political ring, at which point opponents then derided it as a well-thought-out publicity stunt to raise his public profile in a deliberate attempt to draw comparisons to John F. Kennedy's Profiles in Courage. When he decided to enter politics as a Democrat, the party elites were ecstatic to have a combat-tested veteran in their ranks at a time when they needed credibility on the foreign policy front. He became a darling of the liberal media with answers that came across as compassionate yet firm, even when his stance took a more libertarian position. Comparisons to JFK were in the talking points from a media establishment still enamored with the myth that was Camelot. That was all part of Alec's plan. Running for California's 25th congressional district, he won a narrow victory in a self-funded campaign. While his opponents said he was buying the election, Alec pointed to her ties to special interest groups, in particular her support of the pharmaceutical industry's pain clinics, which were nothing more than opioid pill mills, ruining lives in a deliberate campaign to addict, decimating entire communities, while enriching corporate leadership, lobbyists, and the politicians who made it all possible. As a primary reason for much-needed change, Alec's campaign highlighted the amount of wealth the incumbent had accumulated over the course of her 26 years in Congress, much of it coming from the highly unpopular opioid industry. It didn't hurt that he polled very well with females of both parties, in a district that was almost split down the middle politically. It was said that Republican housewives made the difference. It's hard to compete with the story of running into a burning building after the woman you love, especially when it's true. Alex studied the life and political career of the legendary John Dingell of Michigan. As a liberal Democrat from the Rust Belt, Congressman Dingell would become the longest-serving member of the House of Representatives in congressional history, while holding strong to his steadfast belief in the individual, fundamental right to self-defense. He clearly articulated how the firearm transcended the changing political whims of his party. His 60 years of government service were proof to Alec that those positions were consistent with a progressive agenda and could still win elections in California. It didn't hurt to have millions of new gun owners who had changed their positions on private gun ownership as they watched their cities descend into chaos the summer of the presidential election. They didn't want to abandon their party, nor did they want to rally behind a movement with a rallying cry of defund the police. Alec offered a strong alternative. He was an early adopter and one of the first to harness the power of social media. As with most technical innovations, the establishment was slow to adapt. Alec was not. His days in Silicon Valley, along with his time in combat, taught him that adapting faster than your enemy led to victory. He built his platforms using the best digital designers and tailored his message to a more libertarian-leaning youth segment of the voter bloc. Decriminalizing certain drugs on one side, staunchly supporting the Second Amendment on the other, while championing the environment and a sustainable health care plan, all falling under the umbrella of freedom, resonated. Later there would be those who would accuse his friends in that early tech startup of manipulating social media algorithms to get one of their own into the White House. Was that true? Even Alec didn't know for certain. What most people saw was a young, vibrant, wealthy, handsome candidate with a background tailor-made for politics. He fit the fairy tale. Though many in his own party despised his success, the elites also saw him as a future presidential candidate. There was even talk of a presidential run early on, especially after he took the stage as a newly minted congressman at the 2008 Democratic Convention in opposition to the war in Iraq. They had wanted to trot out a respected young anti-war face of the party as a way to solidify the youth vote during a time when support for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan was at an all-time low. As always, Alec was thoughtful in his remarks, well-informed on geopolitics, and most important, likable, causing many commentators to wonder aloud why the Democratic Party wasn't running him, at least as a VP pick. Alec was patient. He learned how Washington worked. He cultivated the relationships that would allow him to operate effectively in the swamp while remaining popular in California, a state he would have to win in a presidential bid. He laid the groundwork, continued to build his social platforms, and harness their power. No longer was he dependent on the kingmakers of the legacy media establishment. Their power was waning, but they were too self-absorbed to notice. He built his own platforms in the new media and focused his messaging on those who digested their news via their smartphones and made their decisions largely based on influencers. He started a podcast before most people even knew what they were. Legacy print and cable media scoffed at him, but by the time he announced his campaign for the 2020 presidential election, his podcast reach dwarfed the ratings of those in conventional media, the same media that continued to make cynical comments night after night from their sound stages in New York, D.C., and Atlanta. He could talk directly to the people and continue to build his base through engaging content and considerate conversations. He dominated the new media space in a way the rest of the Democratic field could only dream about. He studied the data, capitalized on relationships with influencers to co-opt segments of their audiences, and built a voting bloc powerful enough to sway an election. That power made the party elite nervous. He was not under their control and therefore was unpredictable. But they also saw him as a way back into 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Both Alec and the party leadership knew he would have to go farther left for his vice presidential pick to balance the ticket, a chance to keep power for a 16-year run. If they wanted to fundamentally transform the country, they were going to have to support the popular congressman. His vice presidential pick from Florida's 9th district made him the first president in U.S. history to win with a female on the ticket. The fact that she was an Army JAG Corps veteran and of Cuban descent brought in the electoral votes from one of the more hotly contested battleground states in recent history. That she remained a major in the National Guard and outranked the new commander-in-chief, who had been medically retired as a first lieutenant due to his combat injuries, was a source of ample comedic material for the late-night talk shows. Even the women of The View could not stop themselves from fawning all over them both. It kept Alec center stage and made him relatable. As the most eligible bachelor in D.C., he was a staple on the covers of magazines at supermarket checkout lines. In a world where a reality show about finding love trumped ratings across the board, he was a star. He enjoyed female company, but it always became clear after a few months that they would never be his top priority. Truth be told, his attention was on a ghost, one that was never far away. Alec turned from the window and looked down at the resolute desk, which had been a part of the room since Queen Victoria had presented it to President Rutherford B. Hayes in 1880. It was built from wood, recovered from the HMS Resolute, a British ship that was abandoned after becoming trapped in the ice while on an Arctic expedition in 1854. An American whaler recovered the ship 2 years later and returned it to the United Kingdom. President Christensen looked at it as a symbol of hope and resolve. Just shy of 100 years after fighting the war for independence, the former colonial rulers gifted a desk made from one of their naval vessels to the leader of the country that defeated them. After contentious beginnings and the war that birthed a nation, the two countries had become the staunchest of allies. He rarely walked into the Oval Office without thinking of the iconic photo of JFK working that very desk with John Jr. peeking out through the knee-hole panel at his feet, a photo that would not be published until after the assassination in Dallas. President Christensen took a breath and looked at the four files on his desk. They had been delivered by his national security advisor that morning. Three of them were the reason for the journey he'd taken over the past 20 years. The president is the only person in all of government who has unfettered access to the nation's most closely guarded secrets. Everyone else is read into and out of special access programs based on need to know. Information is compartmentalized for reasons of national security. The real trick is knowing what to ask for and where to look. The young president was searching for something specific. Alec had not made his request immediately upon taking office. He had already waited 2 decades. He could wait a few more months. The new president needed to learn, research, and plan. He needed to lead. He had inherited a country still reeling from the economic repercussions of an almost complete shutdown in response to a virus that had originated halfway around the world. The follow-on civil unrest had devastated the nation. Those wounds were slowly healing, in large part due to Alec's leadership. He'd had access to some of the documents included in the files when he was in Congress, but there were two new files that he was particularly interested in today. The commander-in-chief pressed his knuckles into the oak timbers of the presidential desk, his left hand still bearing the scars from the Taliban bullet, the tinnitus in his ears from the IED reminding him that he'd never truly be at peace. That was okay. Peace was not what he was after. He'd already read two of the files front to back. They were stacked to his left. Alec looked down at the two remaining folders. One was labeled Executive Order 12333. He flipped to Part 2, Paragraph 13, Prohibition on Assassination. His eyes scanned the section of the order, a version of which had been signed or strengthened by every president since Gerald Ford. No person employed by or acting on behalf of the United States government shall engage in or conspire to engage in assassination. The president then shifted his gaze to the last file. It had been delivered by the CIA that morning and passed to the National Security Advisor, who in turn had placed it on the president's desk. It was labeled Director of National Intelligence, Top Secret, Psi Gamma, TK, HCS, RSV, KDK, No Forn, Handle via Executive Channels Only. Under those code words and control labels was a name, James Reese. The president flipped the page and began to read. Chapter 5. John F. Kennedy International Airport, New York, New York. Ali Reza Ansari made sure he wasn't the first to exit the jetway. He didn't want to look overly eager to anyone monitoring the cameras or facial recognition programs, constantly scanning every face deplaning in one of the busiest airports on Earth. He'd specified with his travel department that he'd like a window seat near the rear of the business class cabin. That would be expected for someone in his position and would put him near the back of the first pack of deplaning passengers. He'd been with Biodyne Medical Systems for 17 years. A global healthcare company headquartered in Switzerland, it boasted research and manufacturing facilities in Germany, Switzerland, Ireland, Canada, and what they referred to as the Central Eastern European region. Ali had first interned with them as a graduate student pursuing dual-track business and pharmaceutical sciences degrees from Saarland University in Germany. Biodyne was also one of the few biomedical research companies with research and distribution networks in both the United States and Iran. Biodyne was a respected, progressive, and diverse company that traced its roots back to 1758, when it was founded as a trading business specializing in chemicals, dyes, and pharmaceuticals. It was called Andros and Sons then, and for their first 100 years they focused on producing alizarin blue and oramine dyes. It wasn't until the late 1800s that they developed a medical-grade pharmaceutical, an antiseptic for soothing arthritis. With that success, the company shifted to the research and development of medicines in their Basel, Switzerland chemical plant. In 1971, they sold to Glencore Trading Company. That merger gave them international reach through research labs and manufacturing plants in Europe, North America, and the Middle East. In 1997, they merged again, this time with one of the largest healthcare companies in the world, becoming Biodyne, with biomedical research labs in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Tehran, Iran, through a partnership with the Iranian Communicable Disease Research Center. Ali got into the line for non-U.S. citizens and waited patiently for his turn with the Customs and Border Protection official, who opened his Swiss passport and compared the photo to the man on the other side of the glass. Ali offered a pleasant smile as the uniformed officer scanned the barcode and shifted his eyes to the computer. Why the United States did not screen passengers ahead of time, like El Al, Ali would never understand. He'd also never fly El Al.
"What is the purpose of your visit?" the CBP officer asked.
"Business," Ali replied with only the slightest hint of an accent, as he'd done at least 100 times over the years.
"And what kind of business is that?"
"A medical device technology company," Ali replied, not offering any more than required. Pharmaceuticals had the tendency to be off-putting with so much bad press around the opioid epidemic in America. It seemed as if the venerable news program 60 Minutes ran weekly segments on Big Pharma's shady lobbying and marketing practices, pointing out that opioids killed more Americans annually than were killed during the entire Vietnam War. What the West called terrorism had nothing on opioids. Even though Biodyne did not manufacture the devastating drugs, Ali did not want to highlight the pharmaceutical side of the company to someone who might be related to one of the thousands affected by a highly addictive narcotic. The official flipped pages in the passport looking for stamps from Yemen, Afghanistan, or Pakistan, which would lead to additional questions and a possible secondary screening.
"How long will you be staying in the United States?"
"About a week," Ali lied.
The official found a blank page and stamped it with an entry date before returning Ali's passport under the plexiglass partition.
"Enjoy your stay," he said,
nodding to the next person in line. Ali made his way casually into the international baggage claim, noting exits and careful to pay just the right amount of attention to the armed police patrolling the area. He was also sure to force a disarming smile when he passed by a police officer with one of the Americans' canines by his side. Americans loved their dogs. Filthy animals. Senior lab manager with one of the world's leading medical technology companies was not the career field to which Ali aspired in his youth. He'd only wanted to kill Iraqis and Americans. Ali couldn't even remember the last time he'd seen his father. He was still in the crawling stage when his dad was conscripted into military service. 2 years later, his oldest brother would leave for the front lines, followed 5 years later by his middle brother, who would fight in the final battles of the Holy Defense, a conflict the rest of the world insisted on calling the Iran-Iraq War. His mother had not been notified by a knock on the door as he'd seen in so many American movies. Rather, a list of the dead and missing was posted each week in the town square. The list was displayed a good distance from the Provincial Society office, the locally elected Islamic council responsible for coordinating regional affairs with the Islamic Consultative Assembly in Tehran. The politicians seemed more afraid of backlash from Iranian mothers and widows than they were of invading Iraqi forces. Young Ali would accompany his mother to town each week in search of news. She would leave him in a chair by a butcher stand on the corner and push her way through the crowds to read the names, praying to Allah for the safe return of her loved ones. The stench of rotting meat behind the thin curtain would stay with Ali the remainder of his life. He could live with the smell. What haunted his dreams were the wailings of the women, their screams as they read the names of husbands and sons they'd never see again, would fuel his every decision. The list offered no cause of death, no locations. The bodies were buried on the battlefield out of necessity, often in mass graves. Rarely was it possible for the dead to receive a proper Islamic burial as mandated by Sharia law. In wartime, one must make sacrifices. They would mourn his older brother first, killed in the early days of the war in a human wave attack in the marshes of Basra in 1982. At 15 years of age, he'd received a week of training before being sent to the front lines. The cult of the martyr had become a powerful instrument of the state. Whether he was killed by artillery, rockets, tanks, or small arms fire, or hunted down by the devastatingly effective Mi-25 helicopters, using the same hunter-killer tactics the Soviets had used against the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, Ali would never know. His only connection to his older sibling would come years later in the Iranian Martyrs Museum in Tehran, where he'd found his brother's picture encased under a glass display. Additional research would reveal that his father had been a victim of a sarin gas attack in the town of Halabja, Iraq, in March 1988. As a soldier and then university student, Ali would spend hours sifting through available photographs of the battle, trying to identify his father among the bloated bodies of the dead. Iraq's chemical weapon attacks would kill thousands of Iranians and expose even more to the deadly contaminants. Even 30 years following the UN-brokered end of hostilities, close to 100,000 Iranians were still receiving medical treatment for the lifelong effects of the toxins. Open-source declassified CIA documents would confirm that by 1984, the American Intelligence Agency was aware of Iraq's use of chemical weapons in violation of international law. An ally of Iraq, the United States not only remained silent, but ramped up their military and intelligence support of Saddam Hussein's troops, even using their clout with the United Nations Security Council to block condemnation of Iraq when UN investigators presented unrefuted proof of the use of banned weapons by the Iraqi regime. Free of condemnation, Iraq increased its use of weaponized neurotoxins through the end of the war in 1988. Ugly things are done in times of war, Ali knew. Heads are turned. Reports are falsified. Evidence is buried. The United States should have done a better job at covering their tracks. It was U.S. satellite imagery provided to Iraq that allowed them to effectively target advancing Iranian troops that March day in 1988, the day Ali's father was killed. The Americans were responsible for the excruciating deaths that morning. Bodies of women and children scattered among the soldiers, their faces contorted in agony. Gas was not a precision weapon system and did not discriminate between combatants and civilians. In 1982, deciding that an Iranian victory was contrary to U.S. foreign policy objectives, President Reagan removed Iraq from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. The military-industrial complex, about which Eisenhower had so solemnly warned, was in full swing. War was big business. Reagan's actions opened the door to military equipment and munitions sales to include the dual-use technology that would allow Iraq to produce and weaponize the chemicals that would give them the upper hand against the Iranians. The same poisons that had altered the course of Ali's life. In the popular press, Iran was portrayed as the instigator, which made it easier for the world to support the Ba'athists in Iraq. With $1 billion a month flowing in from Saudi Arabia, Iraq was able to purchase weapons from the United States, the Soviet Union, and the countries of Western Europe. Howitzers, Exocet missiles, Gazelle helicopters, Mirage jets, Soviet